The Radio Memories Network is brought to you in part by Liberated Syndication. Podcast publishing made easy. Libsyn.com. That's LIBSYN.com.
Quiet, please. Quiet, please.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen of the radio audience. This is Graham McNamee speaking. Again, we bring you a period of delightful entertainment.
Sensational wonder today, we know. Everyone is talking and fooling with radio. It's a wireless telephone. I just bought one of my own. Now I sit at home alone and hear them dish the dirt. But all that I can hear is buzzing in my ear is.
Welcome to Adventures in Radio for Tuesday, July 25th, 2006. Beginning this week, I want to spend a few podcasts of Adventures in Radio looking at the radio career of one of the foremost geniuses of the entertainment media, but especially of radio, Orson Welles. Welles is a prolific image throughout the history of dramatic radio. It is an image that mirrored his stage credentials through his repertory group, the Mercury Theater. Beginning as a group of actors who sought to bring new life to the theater with updated dramatic productions of the classics, including especially the works of Shakespeare, it was founded by both Welles and John Houseman. Its genius began in the Federal Theater Project's production of Mark Blitzstein's union opera, The Cradle Will Rock. You can get a sense of that history through the recent film by Tim Robbins of the same name. The group became known for their stage productions, putting the characters from Shakespeare into modern dress and more modern situations while maintaining the language and flow of the bard. It wasn't long before radio found them and, in an agreement with the Columbia Broadcasting System, began producing a series of plays sustained by the network. Welles was not new to radio. His career in the medium began with a role in an Archibald MacLeish play called Panic, then with appearances in radio's March of Time, which broadcast over NBC dramatic interpretations of each week's news. Welles' deep baritone could often be heard in adult roles, though he was still a teenager. After several other various appearances, he found himself in a new series for radio, which is one of the best remembered, as Lamont Cranston in The Shadow.
I was the original Lamont Cranston. People keep talking about it. I hear on television, people keep talking, making jokes about Lamont Cranston, and they don't know I was it. I keep wanting to say, that was me!
That was Welles and one of the few times he mentions that he appeared in The Shadow. The Mercury Theater on the air afforded an opportunity for both Houseman and Welles to bring their New York-based theater troupe to national audiences. The series brought many of literature's classics to radio. Welles would star in all of them, but the excellent supporting cast made the complete production the quality radio series that it was. However, unfortunately, it wasn't until their broadcast of an adaptation of H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds that the program achieved fame. After that, it acquired a sponsor in the Campbell Soups, and the series changed names. But at the same time, with the sponsor came loss of control that they previously held despite the powerful force of Orson Welles. It was the opening production of the Mercury Theater on the air that you will hear on this week's podcast. The year was 1938 in July, a momentous year in the 20th century as the forces of evil seemed to be on the march in Europe. As Harry Heusser points out in his excellent blog on early radio drama, Broadcastellan at broadcastellan.blogspot.com, it might not be a coincidence that Dracula was the first selection of the Mercury Theater on the air. Given that several months later the group would broadcast H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, adapted as a comment on the rising fascism of the time, the selection of Dracula, a story of triumph over evil, seems very deliberate. Like Stoker's novel, which uses diaries and telegrams to tell its story, the Welles-Houseman production stays true to the novel, though, if you've read the original, the radio version is rushed as it moves through its one-hour broadcast. Orson Welles at this time was only 23 years old, though it's hard to imagine someone so young with so mature a voice. But in a time when voice was everything on radio, this boy genius made radio his blackboard for creative ideas. In upcoming podcasts, I'll be presenting some other creative examples of Orson Welles, though the Mercury Theater was probably his greatest triumph of the medium. Here now is the Mercury Theater production of Bram Stoker's gothic horror novel, Dracula, from July 1938.
The Columbia Network takes pride in presenting Orson Welles in the first production of a unique new summer series by the Mercury Theater on the air. In a single year, the first in the life of the Mercury Theater, Orson Welles has come to be the most famous name of our time in American drama. Says Collier's Magazine,
23-year-old Orson Welles threw a bombshell into Broadway.
Robert Benchley writes in The New Yorker,
the production of the Mercury is, I should say, just about perfect.
Time Magazine declares,
the brightest moon that has risen over Broadway in years. Welles should feel at home in the sky, for the sky is the only limit which his ambitions recognize.
And finally, the United Press remarks,
the meteoric rise of Orson Welles' Mercury Theater continues unabated.
With four hit shows in its first year, the Mercury might well close its door on a season unparalleled in Broadway history. But Mr. Welles has long been working on a project for a greater audience, the Broadways of the entire United States. The Columbia Network is proud to give Orson Welles the opportunity to bring to the air those same qualities of vitality and imagination that have made him the most talked-of theatrical director in America today. And it is this project which Columbia brings you this summer, the first time in its history that radio has ever extended such an invitation to an entire theatrical institution. But here is Orson Welles himself to tell you about it, the director of the Mercury Theater, the star and producer of these programs, Orson Welles.
Good evening. The Mercury Theater faces tonight a challenge and an opportunity for which we are grateful. We will present during the next 9 weeks many different kinds of stories. Stories of romance and adventure, biography, mystery, and human emotion. Stories by authors like Robert Louis Stevenson, Emile Zola, Dostoevsky, Edgar Allan Poe, and P.G. Wodehouse. And the cast tonight are Martin Gable, the Cassius of our production of Julius Caesar, and George Koulouris, who played Antony in that production and appeared also in our Shoemaker's Holiday and Heartbreak House, and other leading Mercury Theater players. We're starting off tonight with the best story of its kind ever written. You will find it in every representative library of classic English narratives. It is Bram Stoker's Dracula. The next time I speak to you, I'm Dr. Arthur Seward. George Koulouris plays Jonathan Harker, and Martin Gable plays Dr. Van Helsing. It is Dr. Seward who tells the story. And so for the moment, goodbye, ladies and gentlemen. I'll see you in Transylvania.
Mercury Theater on the Air presents Orson Welles as Count Dracula in his own version of Bram Stoker's great novel, Dracula.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Arthur Seward. I'm here tonight to bear witness to the truth of certain events which you may find it hard to believe, but I ask you to believe them. I have here certain documents, telegrams, clippings from the press of the day, memoranda, and letters in various hands. All needless matters have been eliminated, so that a history almost at variance with the possibilities of contemporary belief may stand forth as simple fact. I present you first with excerpts from the private journal of Jonathan Harker.
I, Jonathan Harker, lawyer class, article to Peter Hawkins, Esquire of Exeter, England, am writing this journal in the hope that if misfortune overtakes me, it may one day come to the eyes of those who love me. I set out from London on the last day of April to visit one of our clients in Eastern Europe. On May the 3rd, I arrived in Budapest and came after nightfall to Klausenburg on the borders of Transylvania. At Bistritz, there was a letter of welcome for me from our client, informing me that his carriage would await me at the Borgo Pass. It was signed Dracula. Thank you.
Bukovina! Couch for Bukovina!
The road was rough, but still we seemed to fly over it with feverish haste. When it grew dark, there seemed to be some excitement among the passengers. They kept speaking to the driver and looking at me and urging him on to greater speed. The crazy coach rocked on its great leather spring. The mountains seemed to come nearer to us on either side.
Coachman! Coachman!
What is it? Where are we?
You're nearing your destination, young hare. This is the Borga Pass.
There were black, rolling clouds overhead, and in the air they hear a pressing sense of thunder. Now, we were through the pass.
The young hare is not expected after all.
You are early tonight, my friend.
A calèche with four horses had drawn up beside us.
Let me help you, sir.
The coachman smiled, and a lamplight fell on a hard-looking mouth with very red lips and sharp-looking teeth as white as ivory. We began to move. I looked back. The coach and his load of passengers had vanished from sight. We swept into the darkness of the pass. I struck a match. It was within a few minutes of midnight. And then a dog began to howl somewhere far down the road. The wind was rising, moaned and whistled through the rocks, and the branches of the trees crashed together as we swept along. It grew colder and colder still, and fine powdery snow began to fall. The baying of wolves sounded nearer and nearer, as though they were closing round us on this side. Weeks on ascending, always ascending. The howling of wolves was growing less. Presently, it ceased altogether. And just then, the moon broke through the black cloud, and by its light, I saw around us a ring of wolves running alongside the carriage, in silence, with white teeth and lolling red tongues, with long sinuated limbs and shaggy hair.
Welcome to my heart.
I must have fallen asleep. The carriage had pulled up in the courtyard of a vast ruined castle. The coachman was nowhere to be seen.
Welcome to my house. Come freely, go safely, and leave something of the happiness you bring.
Count Dracula?
I am Dracula.
The face was strong, very strong, aquiline. The mouth, so far as I could see under the heavy mustache, was fixed and rather cruel looking, with peculiarly sharp white teeth.
You hear them, Mr. Harker?
The wolves?
The children of the night, as you say, Mr. Harker. The wolves. Listen. Come now. There are many things you must tell me tomorrow. Of England and of the estate that you have purchased for me.
Why, yes.
The estate is called Carfax, I believe.
Yes, that is so.
But now I will detain you no longer. You will find your room in readiness. And I advise you not to leave it during the night.
This castle is on the very edge of a terrible precipice. A stone falling from the window would fall 1,000 feet without touching anything. I explored. There are doors, doors, doors everywhere, and all of them locked. The door to the great hall, the door to the courtyard, every door in the castle is closed, bolted against me. The castle of Dracula is a prison, and I am a prisoner. The next night, I could not sleep. So after a few hours, I got up and, lighting my candle, I placed my shaving mirror on the dressing table and was just beginning to shave.
You seem restless, Mr. Harker.
I had not seen him, although the reflection of the glass covered the whole room behind me. I turned to the glass again. Count Dracula was close to me, and I could see him over my shoulder, but there was no reflection of him in the mirror. It was blank. I started and cut myself on the side of the throat. The blood was trickling down my neck.
Count, my mirror!
The blood. Wipe the blood from your face, Mr. Harker. And take care how you cut yourself. It is more dangerous than you think in this country.
When I woke, I found most of my things were gone. My passport, my notes, my letter of credit. I could find no trace of them anywhere. And my door is locked from the outside. June 20th. There is work of some kind going on in the castle. Now and then I hear the faraway muffled sound of mattock and spade. And last night, the second of the predated letters which Dracula made me write, the second of that series which is to blot out the very traces of my existence from the earth, went forth. Count Dracula.
Yes, my young friend.
Well, what of me? When am I free? When can I leave this place?
Free? Mr. Harker, you're always free. You want to leave? Would you like to leave tonight?
Yes, yes, in God's name.
My dear young friend, not an hour shall you wait in my house against your will. Come, follow me. The door seems to be bolted. How strange. The door is locked.
Well, in God's name, open it.
As you will, Mr. Harker. You English have a proverb which is very close to my heart. Welcome the coming, speed the parting guest. Good night, Mr. Harker.
Shut the door! Shut the door! I tell you, shut the door!
The door is shut, Mr. Harker. I take it you will remain.
Morning, June the 30th. These may be the last words I ever write in this diary. Oh, God preserve my sanity. I have never seen Count Dracula by day. At sunrise, at the first cockcrow, he is gone. I do not understand these things. I only know that the wolves obey him, and that he is a man with hair on the palm of his hands, with sharp teeth, and no blood in his face. He casts no shadow. He cannot be seen in a glass. And he moves like a bat across the sheer face of the castle walls. He eats no food and is mortally afraid of the crucifix. As I write this, I hear in the courtyard the rolling of heavy wheels and the cracking of whips. And there is in the passageway below a sound of heavy boxes being set down, boxes shaped like coffins. And I know what they hold. Boxes are filled with holy earth from the chapel beneath the castle. Box being nailed down. And now I hear the heavy feet tramping again. The door shut. The chains rattle. In the courtyard and down the rocky way, the roll of heavy wheels, the crack of whips. Wagons have gone. I'm alone in the castle. I'm alone in the castle. I'm alone in the castle. I'm alone. I'm alone. I'm alone.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Dr. Seward. Mr. Harker's journal terminates at this point. I now present in evidence a clipping dated August 8th of that year from the Yorkshire Telegraph from our correspondent in Whitby. One of the greatest and suddenest storms on record was experienced here today. The weather has been somewhat sultry, but Saturday evening was fine. The band was playing. The piers were crowded with holidaymakers. The wind fell away entirely during the evening, and there was a dead calm. There were but few lights at sea. The only sail noticeable was a foreign schooner under full canvas, which was seemingly going westward. A little after midnight came a strange sound from over the sea, and high overhead the air began to carry a strange, faint, hollow booming. Then, without warning, the tempest broke. And there, with all sails set, was the foreign schooner rushing with terrific speed toward the shore. A searchlight was turned on her. And there, lashed to the helm, was a corpse with drooping head which swayed horribly to and fro at each motion of the ship. A moment later, she crashed. And then a strange thing was seen. At the very instant she touched, a huge dog sprang up on deck from below and, running forward, jumped from the bow onto the sand and, making straight up the east cliff toward the graveyard, vanished into the night. The Coast Guard, going aboard at dawn, found the dead man fastened to a spoke of the wheel. Tightly clutched in one hand was a crucifix. The man must have been dead for quite 2 days. In the pocket of the dead man's coat was found a bottle, carefully corked, containing a roll of paper. This proved to be an addendum to the ship's log. There was found on board only a small amount of cargo, and that of a most unusual nature. Apparently the ship carried nothing but earth. Common earth. Packed away in wooden boxes. Shaped much like coffins.
Log of the Demeter. Russian flag, Black Sea, to Whitby. July 6th. Finished taking in cargo, a queer cargo, boxes of earth. At noon, set sail, east wind, fresh. Crew, four hands, two mates, cook, and myself, captain. July 11th. Entered Bosporus. At dark, passed through Dardanelles. Mate reported in morning that one of crew, Valjodin, was missing.
Took larboard watch, 8 bells last night. She was relieved by Chilege.
Never came to
his
bunk.
Something aboard this ship.
No. Don't laugh, captain. In the rain last night.
Oh.
A tall, thin man go up companionway and along the deck forward and disappeared. When I go to the bow, no one. And the hatchways all closed.
July 22nd. Rough weather last 3 days. All hands busy with sails. No time be frightened. Past Gibraltar and out through straits. All well. July 24th. Last night, another hand was lost. Disappeared.
By Chilichev. Leave all watch midnight. Then we never see him again.
Oh, double watch now.
Everyone, I don't take watch alone no more.
Double watch.
Double watch.
July 29th. Had single watch tonight as crew too tired to double. When morning comes...
Hey, Milo! Baranjin! Baranjin! Is Baranjin below?
Baranjin's gone! Baranjin's gone like the others!
Like all the others.
The mate and I have agreed to go armed henceforth. July 30th. Last night, we are nearing England. Weather fine. All sail set.
Captain! Captain! The man in the watch of the steersman missing! Both missing!
Now, only self and mate and one hand left to work ship. August 3rd. 2 days of fog and not a sail sighted. At midnight, I went to relieve the man at wheel, and when I got to it, found no one there.
It's here! I know it now. I saw it like a man, tall and thin and ghastly pale. It was in the bows looking out. I gave it the knife, and my knife went through it.
What?
Empty as air.
What is it? What are you talking about?
It's here, and I'll find it. It's in the hold, in one of those boxes of earth. I'll unscrew them one by one and see. And see.
He is mad. Stark raving mad. It's no use my trying to stop him. He can't hurt those big boxes. They are invoiced as common earth.
He's there. Down in the hold. I know the secret now. The sea will save me from him. That's all that's left. That's all that's left.
August 4th. I am all alone on my ship. And still the fog. I dared not go below. I dared not leave the helm. So here all night I stayed. And in the dimness of the night, I saw it. I saw him. God forgive me, but the mate was right to jump overboard. It was better to die like a sailor in the blue water. But I am captain, and I must not leave my ship. I shall tie my hands to the wheel when my strength begins to fail, And along with them I shall tie that which it dare not touch, my crucifix. I am growing weaker, and the night is coming on. God and the Blessed Virgin, help a poor ignorant soul trying to do his duty.
You are listening to the Columbia Network's first presentation in a new summer series of unique dramatic productions featuring Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air. In just a moment, our story of Bram Stoker's Dracula will continue. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System. We continue now with Columbia Network's presentation of Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in Dracula.
Telegram, Seward, Pursuit, to Van Helsing, Amsterdam. Lucy Westenra in alarming condition. Cannot diagnose. Come at once. Seward.
Telegram, Van Helsing, Amsterdam, to Seward, Pursuit. I'm on my way to you. Please arrange the examined patient immediately my arrival, Van Helsing.
Ladies and gentlemen, I must now explain that 6 months before the events recorded here, I had become engaged to a young lady, Lucy Westenra. We were to have been married in the spring. My old teacher, Professor Van Helsing, arrived at 4 the next afternoon. I took him at once to Lucy's house. She lay in a bed asleep. She was ghastly, chalky pale. The red seemed to have gone even from her lips and gums. And the bones of her face stood out.
Young miss is bad. Very bad. She must have blood or she will die. Yet she is not anemic. The qualitative analysis of her blood gives quite normal condition. It is strange. I do not like to think how strange. Look! My God, her throat, look!
The black velvet band that she always wore had dragged up a little and showed a red mark on her throat. Just over the external jugular vein were two punctures, not large, but not wholesome looking. The edges were white and worn looking. Well? Well, what is it, Professor? What's wrong with her? Speak frankly. You can tell me the worst.
I wish I could, Seward. I wish I could. But I do not dare.
But won't you tell me anything?
I will tell you this. Your young lady is in a danger greater than death. You must believe me. If you leave her for one moment and harm befalls, you will not sleep easy thereafter.
September 8th. I sat up all night with Lucy.
Arthur, I'm afraid.
My dear, you can sleep tonight. I'm here watching you. Nothing can happen. And I promise if any sign of bad dreams, if I see anything, I'll wake you at once.
You will? Will you really? Then I'll sleep.
I sat all night by her bedside. And she did not wake once during the night, although a bows or a bat or something flapped almost angrily against the window panes. September 11th. Still quoting from my private journals. It was this time that I received a message from Purfleet. It read, 10:20 p.m. St. John's Hospital, serious complications, case 891, your immediate presence, London, imperative. I had no choice. Sometime later, a paper was found among Lucy Westenra's belongings.
I write this and leave it to be seen so that no one may by any chance get into trouble through me. I went to bed as usual, taking care that the window was closed, as Dr. Van Helsing had directed. About 2 a.m, I awakened. I went to the door, called out, Arthur! Arthur! There was no answer. Something's broken the window. I'm in a room alone. I dare not go out. House seems empty. The air is full of specks. floating and circling in the draft from the window. And the light burns blue and dim. What am I to do? Something very sweet and very bitter all around me. And I seem sinking into deep water. And there's singing in my ears.
You shall be flesh of my flesh. Blood of my blood.
September 12th. Late. Only resolution and habit can let me make an entry tonight. We found her sprawled on the floor. There was a draft in the room from the broken window. Her throat was bare, showing the two wounds, looking horribly white and mangled.
We are too late, my friend. We have failed. God's will be done.
She's dying.
Yes. She's dying. Stay beside her. It will make much difference, mark me, whether she dies conscious or in her sleep.
It was late in the afternoon before she opened her eyes.
Arthur, oh, my love, I'm so glad you've come.
I took her hand and knelt beside her. Her breath came and went like a tired, peaceful child's. And then the light from the setting sun fell on her face, and then, insensibly, a strange change came over her. Her eyes grew suddenly dull and hard. Her breathing was heavy. The mouth opened, and the pale gums drawn back made the teeth look large and sharp.
Arthur, oh, my love, I'm so glad you've come. Kissed me. Bend down and kiss me.
Not for your life. Not for your living soul and hers. Lucy! She's dead.
Poor girl. There's peace for her at last. The end.
Not so. It is only the beginning. Wait and see.
Mr. Gazette, September 25th, a Hempstead mystery. The Kensington Horror, the stabbing woman and a woman in black are vividly recalled to mind by a series of events that have taken place recently in the neighborhood of Hempstead. Several cases have occurred of young children straying from home or failing to return from their playing on the heath. In all these cases, the children have given as their excuse that they have been with a beautiful lady who offered them chocolates. In each case, the child was found to be slightly torn or wounded in the throat. The wound seems such as might be made by a rat or a small dog.
The Hempstead Horror. Another child injured by the beautiful lady. We have just received intelligence that another child missed last night was only discovered late in the morning. It has the same tiny wound and throat. Well, Seward, what do you think of that? Do you mean to tell me, my friend, that you still have no suspicion as to what poor Lucy died of?
Nervous prostration, following great loss and waste of blood.
And how was the blood lost or wasted? You are a clever man, my friend, and a good doctor. But you do not believe that there are things that you cannot understand. You are wrong, Seward. Are you aware of all the mysteries of life and death? Can you tell me why, the pampas, there are bats that come at night and open the veins of cattle and horses and suck dry those veins? How in some islands of the western seas there are bats which hang on trees all day? And then when the sailors sleep on deck because it is hot, flit down on them, and then in the morning are found dead men, as white as Miss Lucy was?
I understand none of these things.
After tonight, Seward, if you dare to come with me, perhaps then you will understand.
September 29th.
before dawn. Now it is done. And I would sooner die a thousand deaths than live again through what I did this night.
We will spend the night, you and I, here in this churchyard where Miss Lucy is buried. We enter the tomb.
And then?
We open the coffin. You shall yet be convinced.
Take care, Van Helsing.
Miss Lucy is dead, is it not so? Then there can be no wrong to her. But if she is not dead...
With some difficulty, we found the West Enra tomb. I took up my place behind a yew tree. On one side of the tomb, Van Helsing on the other. I was chilled and frightened. Suddenly, I saw something moving between two yew trees. A dim, white figure which held something at its breast. The figure stopped. I could not see the face, for it was bent down over what I saw to be a fair-haired child. There was a sharp little cry, such as a child gives in sleep, or a dog as it lies before the fire and dreams. Then the thing saw us. She drew back with an angry snarl. The lovely, blood-stained mouth grew to an open square. If ever a face meant death, I saw it at that moment. Then suddenly she turned and vanished in the direction of the tomb.
Child is not harmed. We leave him in a safe place where the police find him. There's more to do. Come!
Now we're in the tomb. There in the coffin, the thing lay. Like a nightmare of Lucy, the pointed teeth, a blood-stained mouth. Van Helsing never looked up. From his bag, he took out a book, his operating knives, a heavy hammer, and a round wooden stake. Some 2 or 3 inches thick, sharpened to a fine point, and hardened over a fire.
Stuart! The life of this unhappy woman is just begun. When she becomes what you call undead, there comes with the change the curse of immortality. She cannot die, but must go on age after age, adding new victims. Because all that die from the preying of the undead become themselves undead and prey on others. So the circle goes on, ever widening as the ripples from a stone thrown in the water. But if this lady, this undead, be made to rest as true dead, then the soul of the poor lady whom we love shall be again free.
Tell me, what am I to do?
Take this stake in your left hand, the hammer in your right.
Yes.
Place the point over the heart.
Yes.
Then, when I begin the prayer for the dead, in God's name strike. Oh. Are you ready? Now, Domine Jesu Christe, Fili de Vivi, qui manus tuas ex voluntate patri.
On the morning of July 11th, a man was found on the border of Transylvania. He talked wildly of wolves and boxes of earth and blood, and gave his name as Jonathan Harker. In the hospital at Klausenburg, he improved sufficiently to make possible his removal to England. I'm still quoting from my own personal papers. But there his condition remained so serious that he was committed for observation to a private ward in my hospital at Purfleet. Here he did so well that in 3 weeks he was completely recovered. It was during this time that his wife, Minna Harker, brought to the attention of Dr. Van Helsing and myself the journal that her husband had kept while a prisoner in the castle of a certain Count Dracula in Transylvania. I have before me the record of a meeting that took place in my study in Purfleet, transcribed by Minna Harker.
October 1st. Meeting began soon after 8. Jonathan next to me. Dr. Seward, opposite to Van Helsing, at the head of the table.
My friends, there are such things as vampires. Had I known at first what now I know, one so precious life had been spared to many of us who love her. The vampire which is amongst us is of himself so strong that he can direct all the elements. The storm, the fog, the thunder, he can command all the meaner things, the moth and bat, the owl and the fox and the wolf. How then are we to begin our strike to destroy him? How shall we find his place? And having found it, how can we destroy? My friends, it is a terrible task that we undertake. To fail here is not mere life or death. If we fail, we
become as him. Foul things of the night, as him. What do you say?
I answer for myself.
Count me in.
I'm with you.
The professor laid a small golden crucifix on the table. We took hands and our solemn pact was made.
My friends, we too are not without strength. The vampire flourishes on the blood of the living. Without this, he cannot live. He throws no shadow. He makes no reflection in a mirror. He can transform himself to a wolf, to a bat. He can come on moonlight rays as elemental dust. He can see in the dark. He can do all these things. Yet he is not free. His power ceases at the coming of the day. Then, until night, he must remain in the shape in which he finds himself and accept in his coffin home, in those earth boxes he cannot rest. When we can confine him in his coffin, then, my friends, if we obey what we know, we will destroy him.
At that moment, something flapped wildly against the window, then...
Did you hit it?
I don't know.
We looked out of the window. Against the black sky, we could see nothing.
Data in our possession. From the Count's castle in Transylvania to Whitby came 50 boxes of earth. All of these, to our certain knowledge, were delivered at Carfax. Recently, 12 of these boxes have been removed. First step, ascertain whether all the rest remain in the deserted house next door or whether any more have been removed. We must trace each of these boxes and sterilize the earth with holy water so that he can no longer seek safety in it. And we must hurry.
The events of the next few days are described in Jonathan Harker's journal.
October 2nd, 5 a.m. Just returned from the empty house. Left Mina here at home. Well, we've done our work at Carfax. The place was filthy. The air stagnant and foul and alive with rats. We counted the boxes. Only 38 of them. And over each one, the professor went through his same mysterious work. It was dawn when we got back. I found Mina asleep. She looks paler than usual.
October 2nd. Soon after they left, I fell asleep. I remember hearing the sudden barking of the dog. And then there was silence. I got up and looked out of the window. There was a thin streak of white mist moving across the grass along the wall of the house. It dawned on me that the air in the room was heavy and dank and cold. The gaslight came only like a tiny red spark through the fog. I could see through my eyelids. The mist grew thicker and thicker. Then, as I looked, the spark divided and seemed to shine on me through the fog like two red eyes.
You shall be flesh of my flesh, blood of my blood, blood of my blood.
October 2nd, 8 p.m. We're on the track. 12 boxes were delivered last week to an empty house at 347 Piccadilly.
My dear friends, until the sun sets tonight, Dracula must retain whatever form he now has. We have this day to hunt out all his lairs and sterilize them. Then he will have no place where he can move and hide. But we have only until sunset.
The house in Piccadilly was empty. Like the one at Purfleet, the same sickening smell was in the air. On a table, we found a clothes brush, a brush, and a comb, and a basin. The latter containing dirty water, which was reddened as if with blood.
The boxes are back here. 8, 9, 10, 11.
Only 11.
There's a 12th box somewhere.
Gentlemen, it is after 6. The sun is setting. We've no time to lose. He will return at any moment. Open the boxes.
Quiet.
Be ready.
It is he! The window!
You waste your bullets, gentlemen. You think you baffle me? You with your pale faces all in a row like sheep in a butcher's. You think you've left me without a place to rest. But I have more. And time is on my side. The one you love is mine already. I have known her. Already my mark is on her throat. Flesh of my flesh. Blood of my blood. She is with me always. Over land or sea.
October 4th morning. Another meeting in the study of Perkins.
We must find that last remaining box, gentlemen. We must find it. As long as that earth exists impure, as long as there remains one place of refuge for Dracula, there is no safety and no peace for any soul in England.
And for the undead, never peace so long as he lives. Blood of my blood. Blood of my blood.
Mina! How do you know that?
Well,
that...
Quiet, quiet.
With me. With me always. Over land and sea.
Mina, darling, how did you know that Dracula said those...
I don't know. The word just came. Strange. There are times when somehow I feel that I'm with him.
At sunset?
Yes. Just at sunset. And again at sunrise. Dr. Van Helsing, if I could... If at that time, you...
Have you the courage?
Courage for what? What do you mean?
Dr. Van Helsing here will question me.
I will question her, yes. In a state of hypnosis. The one you love is already mine, he said. She is with me always, over land or sea. Ah, Count Dracula. Perhaps she will betray you if she is really with you, this one we love. Who knows? If she is really with you over land or sea.
Blood of my blood.
Mina.
Yes?
Answer me, Mina. Are you with him?
Yes, I am with him.
Where are you?
I do not know. It is all dark.
What do you hear?
The lapping of water. I can hear it on the outside.
Then you are on a ship?
Yes.
What else do you hear?
There is the creaking of an anchor
chain.
What
are you doing?
Still. Oh, so still. It is like death. It's like death.
Here is a report from Matson Peabody, shipbrokers. Dated October 5th, according to Lloyd's List, the only sailing ship that left for the Black Sea yesterday was the Tsarina Katrina, bound for Varna. Some hours before she sailed, a man came alongside, all in black, driving a cart with a great box in it. This he lifted down single-handed and carried below. No one remembers having seen him after that, as heavy mist came up over Doolittle Dock until sailing time. The rest of London Harbour remained completely clear.
Our plans are made. The average sailing time from London to the Black Sea is 3 weeks. We can travel overland to the same place in 3 days. We shall be there waiting for him when he arrives.
October 15th, arrive Varna about 5 o'clock. Mina has seemed stronger. Every morning before sunrise and just before sunset, she speaks to Van Helsing in a trance.
Are you with him, Mina? Tell me, are you with him?
I am with him.
What can you see?
Nothing. All is dark.
What can you hear?
I can hear the waves lapping against the ship and the water rushing by. The wind is high. I can hear it in the shrouds and the bow throws back the foam.
So, the Tsarina Katrina is still at sea, hastening on her way to Varna. The Count cannot cross warning water, so he cannot leave the ship without being observed.
What do you hear, Mina?
Lapping waves and rushing water.
A whole week of waiting. Daily telegrams from Lloyd's.
Not yet reported.
Rushing water and creaking mast. Darkness and wind.
October 24th. Telegram. Lloyd's, London to Harker. Tsarina Katrina reported this morning. From Dardanelle.
Lloyd's, London to Harker. October 28th.
Tsarina Katrina in heavy fog reported entering Galatz Harbor today.
Galatz!
Galatz is 38 hours from here, and the first train for Galatz leaves at 6:30 tomorrow morning. My friends, we have lost.
I am with him. I can see nothing. Nothing. I can hear men's voices calling in the roar and creak of all the rocks. I can feel the air.
October 29th, evening. We are due between 2 and 3 in the morning, but already at Bucharest, we are 3 hours late.
Something is going on. I can feel it passing like a cool wind. I can hear far off, confused sounds. Men talking in strange tongues. Tears falling water and the howling of wolves.
What? Speak, Mina. Speak, I command you. I command you to speak.
Arrived in Galatz. Saw Captain Zarina Katrina.
A man come aboard with an order an hour before sunup to receive a box for a party by the name of Dracula. Not his papers, all right, Emmanuel Hildesheim, his name was.
Mr. Hildesheim?
Yes.
You went out of the box yesterday.
I gave it to Kailov by order. Kailov.
Mr. Kailov?
Kailov. This morning they find him dead inside the churchyard of St. Peter. They find him dead with his throat torn open.
October 30th, evening.
There are two ways in which Dracula can get back to his own place. By land or by water.
We've examined the map and find the most likely river is the Ceres.
You and I, Seward, will charter a steam launch and follow him up the river. Van Helsing and Mina will take the train to Veresti, and from there they will...
From there we shall go in the track where Harker went, from Bistritz over to Borgo. If you have not caught him before, we shall be awaiting Dracula there.
October 31st. We arrived at Veresti at noon, Van Helsing and I... Bought a carriage here, and we start in an hour. Our enemy is still on the river.
October 31st. We can run a good speed up the river at night. There's plenty of water, and the banks are wide apart.
November 1st, evening. No news all day. We hear that a big boat went up the river before us, going at more than usual speed.
November 4th. All day driving. The country gets wilder as we go. By morning, we shall reach the Borgo Pass.
November the 4th, evening. We've left the launch. We've got horses, and we follow on the track along the river. We are armed.
Look! Quick! There they are now! Heading west!
With the dawn, we could see the Slovaks some miles before us, dashing along the river with their wagon. On it is the great box.
Afternoon. We reached the Borgo Pass.
Van Helsing, look, look!
We could see a long way all around us. Far off, beyond the white waste of snow, was the river like a black ribbon curling. Between us and the river, not afar off, came a group of men, mounted Slovaks hurrying along. In the midst of them was a wagon which swept from side to side. On the wagon was a great box.
Look!
We see two horsemen following fast, coming up from the south. Stuart and Harker, the Slovaks with their heavy wagon, are losing their ground. Now the horsemen are not more than a mile behind. Now the wagon is quite close to us. We can see the great box swaying crazily. Now they are almost upon us. Now has happened a strange thing. The wagon smashed into a great rock dead in the snow, lost its front wheels, and turned over on its side, jammed against the stone. The horses tore loose from their traces and bolted, and the Slovaks scatter and vanish after them. Then silence. Silence like comes after ringing a bell.
Look, his face.
It is Dracula, sprawled out stiff and twisted in the smear of his own holy earth. The box, in falling,
has emptied the dirt onto the snow. His face is old-looking. The skin is like paper. Dr. Seward, there's no time. Look at the sun.
Sunset.
In 1 minute, there's darkness, and he is forever lost to us. Have you the stake of wood and the hammer?
Yes.
Now, Seward, pray for us. Kneel down and pray. Harker, the stake of wood over his heart. Be not afraid, Harker. Do not look into his eyes. The hammer. Now, Harker, strike. Strike!
Flesh. Flesh of my flesh. Guilt of my guilt. Death of my death. Speak and be manifest in the instant of your master's peril. Elements of darkness. Rain. Evil winds, mist, and mold, and tempest.
Wait!
The others couldn't. But somehow I can hear him speaking behind his eyes.
Claw, wing, tooth, scale, tissue of flesh, death of my death, dead and undead. The hand of the living is over your master. Console him, my children. This instant is no longer than the space between two heartbeats. But the night is not here, and I am lonely. Come to your master, my children. Beguile him now in the instant of his peril. Beguile him with the sound of your names. Claw. Wing, tooth, scale, tissue of flesh.
Strike, Harker, strike!
There is one very dear to me who has not answered. My love, Mina. There is less than a minute between me and the night. You must speak for me. You must speak with my art.
Give them to me! Jonathan, give them to me. That stake of wood and the hammer.
Harker!
I shall never forget that moment. The look on poor Mina's face as she stood there. The angry scar standing out on her throat. Her eyes like living coals in the last red of the sunset. She had torn the stake and the hammer out of my hands with the strength of an enemy.
Mina! Do you know what you've done, woman? Do you know what you've done to us? You've released him, the evilest fiend.
Look! The sun! As we looked down at Dracula, the eyes saw the sinking sun and the hate in them. Turn to triumph.
Flesh of my flesh. Come to me, my love. Come into the night and the darkness. You have served me well. My love. My bride. My...
Ladies and gentlemen, all the evidence in this case is now before you. I've added nothing, and to the best of my knowledge, I've omitted nothing that might help to throw light on the extraordinary events of the year 1891, which culminated on that terrible evening in the Borgo Pass. There remains only this one last report.
When Mina Harker seized the stake and hammer from her husband, I believe she was under some form of hypnosis. She herself remembers nothing. But whatever influence was at work on her, she must, at the last moment, have rejected it. For at the exact instant the sun disappeared, it was Mina Harker who drove the stake through the heart of the thing that called itself Dracula. At that same instant, even as we looked, the wound on the side of her throat was no more. As for Dracula, before the scream of the creature had died from our ears, the whole body crumbled into dust and passed from our sight. In that final moment of dissolution, there was in the face a look of peace, such as I never could have imagined might have rested there.
Tonight's production of Dracula by Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater was the first of 9 CBS broadcasts in which this brilliant group will bring to life a series of great narratives, all presented in the immediacy of the first person singular. In presenting them each Monday evening at this time during the summer season, the Columbia Network is bringing a complete theatrical producing company to the air for the first time. In the cast tonight, Dr. Van Helsing was played by Martin Gable, Jonathan Harker by George Koulouris, Dr. Seward by Orson Welles, the Russian captain by Ray Collins, the mate by Carl Swenson, Mina Harker by Agnes Moorhead, Lucy Westenra by Elizabeth Farrer, and Count Dracula by Orson Welles. Bernard Herrmann composed the original music and conducted. Dan Seymour speaking. Davidson Taylor supervised the production for the Columbia Network. And now here is the director to tell you about next week's Mercury Theater production, Mr. Orson Welles.
Ladies and gentlemen, what are your favorite stories? If there is one you're particularly fond of and would like to hear on the air, will you please write me about it? Next week, the Mercury Theater is going to tell you Robert Louis Stevenson's exciting yarn about pirates and the sea, Treasure Island. Until then, just in case Count Dracula's left you a little apprehensive, one word of comfort. When you go to bed tonight, don't worry. Put out the lights and go to sleep. It's all right. You can rest peacefully. That's just a sound effect. There. Over there in the shadow, see? It's nothing. Nothing at all. Nothing at all. I think it's nothing. But always remember, ladies and gentlemen, there are werewolves. There are vampires. Such things do exist. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Thanks for downloading this podcast of Adventures in Radio. As always, you can reach me by sending an email to otrpodcast@gmail.com or leaving a comment on the website at adventures.libsyn.com.
I just bought one of my own. Now I sit at home alone and hear them.